What is up, Nets fans? Welcome to the Brooklyn Buzz. I'm your host, Nick Faye. With me, as always, Jack Manuel. What's up, Jack?
It's buzz time, ladies and gents.
Yes, it is buzz time. We're giving you a special episode. You know, we had a little break in the schedule, so we figured we'd tackle some different topics. We got a couple fan questions as well. But as always, check out the Buzz on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, NetsRepublic.com, YouTube, and Dash Radio. Any type of support is appreciated. Reviews, shares, retweets, whatever it is. But to get us started, Mark D, YouTube user, had a question for us. Should the Nets trade, let go, or keep Dinwiddie and D'Lo?
I'm thinking, if we're talking long-term, Nick, if we're talking right now, I think it makes the most sense to keep them. We need to see what their value is right now and see what, you know, D'Angelo Russell is continuing to grow as a player. You know, Dinwiddie has shown, you know, even more growth as an offensive force as well. I would, if I'm Sean Marks, if I'm in that front office, I'm keeping at least Dinwiddie. Obviously, the D'Angelo Russell situation is a little more complicated with his impending restricted free agency at the same time. So for me, I'm keeping both because I'm all about building from within. But at the same time, if you're Sean Marks and you have deals out there and trades available, then I'm sure he's going to look at them. You know, I heard a couple of podcasts mentioning the fact that, you know, if Kemba Walker becomes on the market and, you know, he decides to leave Charlotte, is that an asset we sort of look to try and get into? He is a New Yorker, so is that an option? You know, you can't necessarily keep him, D'Lo, and Spencer Dinwiddie all at the same time with Caris LeVert set to come back as well. So I think it makes the most sense to keep them, but if there are opportunities available to explore different options, then, I'm not going one way or another because I think that is the way that the Brooklyn Nets front office is as well. They're generally quite fluid in the way they view their assets. And, you know, I'm waffling on a little bit, but if we look back to, you know, when the Jimmy Butler news was coming around, it was only essentially Caris LeVert and Jared Allen were the non-trade assets. They were the untouchables. So, you know, for D'Angelo and Spencer to sort of be there, they've all, Spencer especially more at the start of the season and even last season was a trade asset. So I think that there'll be conversations around them. We obviously won't hear about them because, you know, the Nets like to keep them quite in-house, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts as well, Nick.
Yeah, I think in this situation, you have to keep one of them. And that's because the point guard position in the NBA is just so important. And we've seen what happens. The Nets have had their lead guard go down year after year. You know, it's Jeremy Lin, D'Angelo missed half last year. He saw Caris LeVert go down this year. I think you keep one of these guys at least. You know, you could keep both, but I think at least one of them, because you don't want to put yourself in a situation where maybe you start to fill out the rest of the roster. You have Caris LeVert at the two guard, you sign a small forward or something or a power forward, then you have Jared Allen, then you have no point guard who can get them the ball. We know Caris can play it a little bit, but I think he's best is that like two guard role that he played this season. So I think right now you definitely try to keep the guy unless somebody comes with a big time offer. And I think Dinwiddie with that extension number makes a ton of sense because even if you were looking to get a guy like Kemba Walker, you still need a backup guard. And like we talked about, Dinwiddie at that number around 12 mil a year is not too bad. So I think you at least keep one of these guys. I don't think you get rid of both because the team isn't talented enough, and it's not like their draft pick is, it's not like they're looking to have a high draft pick for 3 years to kind of gather assets. I think you want to make sure you keep one point guard, but if someone comes in and says, all right, we're going to offer you a big package for one of these guys, you're like, all right, we'll send one of them out, but we're definitely going to keep the other. I think I would agree with you. I kind of lean towards Dinwiddie just because of that number value, and restricted free agents for D'Angelo could be a little bit scary where you could see a team come in, even a team like, let's say the Chicago Bulls want to come in, and we know they offer big offer sheets, or they've signed a Zach LaVine to that big deal. Maybe they want to offer D'Lo a $20 million deal or something along those lines, and he hasn't really performed at that level. So I think Dinwiddie seems like a safer bet, and if somebody offered a great package for D'Angelo, it would make sense. But also, you know, the counter argument, D'Angelo's only 22. He's already showing these flashes. So I think you don't look to get rid of these guys or let them go. I think you at least keep one, and then if somebody comes and offers a big package, you send out one of the guys.
Yeah, Nick, if you're Sean Marks, and we've obviously got it as a question as well, would you rather pay Dinwiddie or D'Lo? I think it's probably best to talk about that now. Obviously, the deal is on the table for Spencer Dinwiddie. It's 4 years, 48, around that mark, 47 and a half. You know, it became available as of, you know, the Knicks game, essentially, that day. If he gets that offered, does that put D'Angelo Russell in place a little bit, sort of go, okay, you've got to prove it now if you want us to pay you as well? Or do you see it more likely playing out the rest of the season and then both guys either get an offer sheet or neither do? Because, you know, D'Angelo does have that quite high cap hold, $21 million or something around that range, I believe. How do you see that all playing out?
Yeah, I think it would put pressure on D'Angelo. I think it'd be like, all right, well, they already locked up Dinwiddie. It's not too high of a number where they couldn't re-sign both of them, but I think it would put a little bit pressure on him. And like you said, with that cap hold, it kind of gives them more flexibility where, all right, no, we renounce his cap hold. He's no longer a restricted free agent. He can sign anywhere. We could still possibly sign him, but it'd be highly unlikely. We go after, let's say, Kemba, Kyrie. We miss out on both of them. Now Spencer Dinwiddie's your starting point guard for next year, which I don't think is terrible.
Yeah, I think Spencer Dinwiddie's probably still a top 15-ish point guard probably in the NBA right now with the way that he's been playing.
Another year of development too.
Exactly. And, you know, I think there's plenty of areas he can continue to develop his game on. You know, he still is, you know, in his mid-20s. There's no way that he's, you know, probably reached his ceiling. I think, obviously, we've talked about it plenty of times, that Dillo has a much higher ceiling. But if you're – let's make some comparisons in terms of D'Angelo Russell for numbers and sort of contracts, Nick. You know, you've got a guy at Miles Turner who's on a 4-year, $64 million deal. Levine's, I think, at 476. What number is a number that you think is fair for D'Angelo Russell? I think as well in the Brooklyn beat, the piece that he did for Nets, he put out four years, $80 million. I think that's a little bit lofty, but I'm interested to hear what you think is a fair number.
I'm going to take an easy way out of this one. I think a lot depends on how he plays the rest of the year. You know, that's going to be a big thing. Is he consistent? You know, we saw a game against the Knicks where he didn't necessarily shoot well, but he had a good impact on the game. Also, Kenny still seems to lean towards Dinwiddie in certain situations. It'll be interesting to see if D'Angelo can kind of earn that trust as the season progresses. It's also hard to tell if the Nets just don't have really high expectations for D'Angelo, where they're trying to really teach him and kind of turn him to an elite type of, you know, playmaker out there, elite point guard, somebody like a Chris Paul that's always making the right play. That's something that I'm kind of keeping an eye on. I think anything over 20 mil is just very risky because you're betting on him becoming a great player. You know, it's going to be impossible to tell by the end of the year if he's going to be a great player unless for some reason he just turns it up. But I think anything between that 15 and 20 mark is probably doable. Anything over 20, I think, would be too much. And that 20 number, he'd have to produce at a really high level. I'm looking at, like, let's say, eight. I would like to see the assist number get up. That would be the biggest number for me. Get that up to maybe, you know, close to 8 assists, 18 points. And I want to see the efficiency pick up. I'm not going to pay someone $20 million to shoot 40% from the field in a mid-30s in three-point percentage.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of guys who are on, you know, not the best of contracts, but these are the sort of deals that you're paying for potential, you know.
Exactly.
Miles Turner, Aaron Gordon, Zach LaVine haven't proven anything yet, so to speak. They've shown glimpses, as has our boy D'Lo. So it is a potential deal at the same time. But the fact is, you know, D'Lo had that goal of playing 82 games, and I think that gives us a larger body of work to sort of judge him on. Whereas you're comparing it to Zach LaVine, he had, you know, missed a large chunk of the season due to that recovery from the ACL injury. So I think the Nets are in a bit of a better spot, obviously knocking on wood the fact that D'Angelo Russell doesn't get injured himself. But, you know, he's already played, you know, he's played every game. I think we're at about 25 or 26. So, you know, all signs are pointing to that he is going to have a healthy season. He looks good-ish, but yeah, I think 50, 60 games time, when we make that judgment, it'll be fascinating to see what that number comes out at.
And I think another point other than the on-court stuff, where it's still on-court, but it's not as much of, you know, the tangible things and the stats. I think it's the effort we see defense. We saw in Toronto, we saw in the Knicks game. I like when I see him put in that extra effort. I like to see him get in the hustle plays, get on the floor a little bit. Obviously, he wants to maintain the health, but just showing he really believes in the team, he's willing to get up. I think this was like an insider, or this was a rumor that was mentioned around. Somebody said that sometimes D'Angelo, you know, tries to play it too cool, where he kind of wants to be almost stylish on the court instead of just like getting down and dirty. You know, obviously that's not a full part of his game, but I think that's something that the Nets want to see him do to kind of maybe be a little bit more interested in investing a lot of money in him.
Yeah, I think we've sort of seen, you know, we know how sort of savvy he is in sort of his persona, D'Angelo. He is a very slick dude. He's making GQ appearances, as did Spencer Dinwiddie. But, you know, he has this, you know, awesome, very media-friendly persona. You know, the fans love him. He's got, you know, the millions of followers on all platforms. So, you know, he has to sort of a reputation to sort of live up to, so to speak. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, that changed throughout the season. He is still a kid, you know, 22 years old. You know, he's finding who he is in this league. And, you know, if you're making comparison to some of the great guards going around, you know, some of the guards who have not have been notorious in not playing defense, guys like Russell Westbrook and James Harden, they've bought in. Well, I mean, you can argue with James Harden maybe a little bit, but those two are starting to play some, you know, comparably average defense, you know, and at least showing effort. So I think, you know, D'Angelo, if he wants to be the leader of this team, if we want him to be, then he needs to set the tone from the sort of defensive standpoint as well. And I think, you know, the past two performances, he has shown that. And I think that that is, you know, a sort of barometer for him. And having guys like, you know, Jared Dudley, Damari Carroll holding him accountable in that sense, guys like Ed Davis as well, I think that's going to be a good thing for him going forward.
I agree. What would be the number for you? What would be the max number you would re-sign him at? Let's say if he finishes the season averaging something close to what he's averaged since the Caris LeVert injury, which is around 20 points, you know, 41% from the field, 32% from three, six assists, and a little bit over three turnovers.
I think it'd be marginally less than Zach LaVine, around that sort of mark of 4 years, $75 million. I don't want to go late 70s. I think, you know, early to mid 70s is fair-ish. But yeah, I would. My ideal number would be like 460, which I think would be somewhat of a bargain deal, because, you know, you're paying for a guy who is only going to get better. And I think Sean Marks is quite crafty in how, and quite wily in how he sort of structures deals and such, and, you know, works the sort of cap space that we sort of are really savoring right now. So, I mean, the number will be what it'll be, but at the same time, I can't see Sean Marks doing an overpay, even though, you know, he has in the past with some offer sheets that he's put out. I'm giving you a nice segue there, Nick.
Yeah, a nice segue. But just touching on D'Angelo real quick, I think you hit on it perfectly, Jack. The incentive-based contract would be ideal for him. You know, becoming an all-star, averaging, you know, a field goal percentage of something, or the turnover or turnover ratio or something. Incentive-based contract for him would make a lot of sense. But thank you for the segue. Going to our next question from Twitter user @_D_rock_. His question is, what if the Nets landed some of those offer sheets referring to, you know, Tyler Johnson, Allen Crabbe, who they ended up trading for, Montionis from Houston, who's no longer in the league, and Otto Porter Jr.? What would be the case if they land? I mean, I don't think they would have been able to land all these guys the way the contracts are structured, especially if they landed, you know, Tyler Johnson and Crabbe at the same time. But where would the Nets be if they got some of these different guys? Would they be in a worse place, a better place? What are you thinking?
I love the what-if game, Nick. The what-if game is always fun when it comes to basketball talk. I think that if you're looking at what the players are right now in their respective organizations, Tyler Johnson, who has been somewhat injury-prone, but, you know, is an athletic, you know, youngish prospect. I think that within the Brooklyn Nets organization, they would be better plays, because I think that they would be utilized better. That might be sacrilege to any Miami Heat fans who might be listening. But I think because of the glut of guards that they have and the sort of deep, weird roster that they have, I think Tyler Johnson would be better utilized. But at the same time, you know, where would he sort of fit in the sort of scheme of things when we have guys like D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie, you know, things, and Caris LeVert? Would Caris LeVert have panned out to be the player that he is? I think Otto Porter makes the most sense in terms of basketball fit. And I think that, you know, he could have, you know, developed maybe more as a guy being able to create his own shot a little bit. And Monte Yunus, another guy who, on a sort of small-ish offer sheet, I think could have given us something as a sort of power forward, stretchy sort of type. But then at the same time, if we do land him, do the Nets go after Rodion Skuritz in the draft, obviously, as a guy who can sort of fill that sort of role going forward? So there's plenty of things in how it affects the other players that we currently have on the roster if we had have landed these guys that Sean Marks handed out the offer sheets to.
I think the Nets would probably be in a worse position. And I think Tyler Johnson, like you mentioned, he probably would be a little bit better on the Nets. But I think at that price tag, I don't see any way his skill set lives up to $19 million. And that's no offense to Tyler Johnson. I think he's a good player, you know, plays hard. I know he's got a couple teeth knocked out from, you know, being such a hustler. But I personally think that they'd probably be in a worse position. And like you said, it would have hurt development of other guys. And then Nets would have almost been closer to being average, or, you know, a below average team that's a little bit better. But now it kind of allowed them to rebuild another year, where maybe if they got both those guys, they would have been a little bit better. And I think that actually would have hurt the development of the team, the culture and whatnot. And then Montiunas is a guy who I think the injury just killed him. You know, he had a back injury. There's not really much you can do about that. Very skilled guy, but it just didn't work out for a reason. He ended up, I think, playing with New Orleans a little bit too the following in that season, because it didn't work out with Houston. So I think the Nets are in a lot better position, and they also kind of put these other teams in a worse position.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of worked out nicely. Hindsight is 2020 and absolutely awesome. But if you're sort of using this as a sort of a way to discredit, Sean Marks, you can all the GMs in the league, even the best ones, Danny Ainge offered 4 first-round picks for bloody Justice Winslow and Frank Kaminsky, all these sort of things. So, there are plenty of times where, the GMs in the league right now are sort of thanking their lucky stars that, some of those things or some of those deals didn't eventually go through. So, there are mistakes that are going to be made. The huge mistakes are often, without being said. Guys like Billy King and Sam Hinkie aren't in the league anymore because of their gargantuan, mistakes, even though, Sam Hinkie is praised to ungodly levels in Philadelphia. It's interesting to see how we sort of judge the GMs by their transactions because, a lot can change with these sort of, a really interesting question by D-Rock because, it's fascinating to imagine where the Nets could be at. I don't think we'd be that much better, but I think, we would be because we'd have some more talented players. But again, I think we're in a much more decent space now and going forward because, that salary cap flexibility, we're in a decent spot with our draft picks as well. I think it's all working pretty nicely.
Exactly. Obviously, in hindsight, you look back in that situation, the Nets had no talent and things worked out with Caris LeVert. They worked out with Jared Allen. They worked out with Joe Harris. They worked out with Spencer Dinwiddie. They made the D'Angelo trade. So obviously now it looks a lot, better. But also cap flexibility wise, going to this offseason and the next offseason, you'd be paying, well, not the next offseason, just the next year, you'd be paying Tyler Johnson, Allen Crabbe almost $40 million.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
that's not going to be a winning team. You know what I mean? They might be a little bit better, but it's not going to be a winning team. Otto Porter is the only guy that still would maybe have intrigued me because, like you said, Jack, I think he develops a little bit better with the Nets. That whole Washington culture is just terrible, and I think he would have fit into what the Nets need, and he'd been an upgrade at that 4 position or 3 position wherever they play him.
Yeah, I think you analyze it with everything that you have on the table right now in terms of how they're performing with their respective organizations, and then how you sort of see their culture fit and how they would fit individually on court and off court with the Nets. But I'm pretty happy with what we've got right now, and I think Sean Marks would be as well. And these are some of the things that you look back on as a general manager, in any sort of thing, you reflect on and go, look. I made some mistakes here. Maybe I need to be a bit more careful going forward because, a guy like Tobias Harris going forward has been linked heavily to the Nets, and as awesome as he's been, and he does have age on his side. How much money are you willing to put on the table if you are the Brooklyn Nets? Do you need to get that, even semi big fish like him to sort of make them relevant and get them into the playoffs? Is that the directive from ownership, or is it, Sean Marks sort of really wanting to sort of make this a bit more reputable? So I think going forward, I'm hoping Sean Marks is going, okay, this is what I need to do. This is what I'm, I can learn from. This is how I can, manage myself and the team going forward.
Yeah, and I think last offseason kind of proved that Sean Marks was kind of taking that steady approach. He could have offered some big contracts, Aaron Gordon or Jabari Parker if he wanted to, and he ended up not doing that. So I feel pretty confident in what he's doing. And I think you asked your question now, you're trying to build a championship team and you're signing a big-time player to a big contract. You have to ask yourself, can he be the best player on a championship team or the second or third best player at this number? Because we know we're going to need so many of these guys and we can't use all the cap if it's not going to work out and they're not going to help us get to the goal that we want to have.
Yeah, the goal is championship contender, and with you want to. I mean, Otto Porter certainly is going to be the number one guy, and it's so hard to get those guys. And I think the best way to get them, other than trade, is via the draft. So I think can Zion Williamson, RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish, Nassir Little, Bol Bol be the number one guy on a championship team? Possibly. I think that that's more likely for the Nets, and that's why, as disappointing as it has been the results so far, a lot of people outside the Nets organization are like, that's probably the best way for them to get a bona fide superstar, your character, because we've seen what we've already done with guys in the mid teens and 20s. Imagine getting a guy like Zion Williamson with all the the talent in the world, and RJ Barrett, who's an absolute stud. I would much rather get one of those guys. It's sort of, because you also have cost control with those guys at the same time. So I'm praying that the lottery balls happen to fall our way at the same time. We do have a still promising and a nice win-loss record by the end of it all too.
Yeah, it's definitely something to keep an eye on. Obviously, like you said, Jack, getting a guy in the draft maybe could help you get a guy the following season in the offseason, a bigger fish in free agency. It's, all how the dominoes fall, and sometimes it's just getting lucky. You know, maybe you sign a guy, maybe they get D'Angelo for a steal in this offseason. No one's really that interested to him. He blossoms into an all-star. Same thing that would happen with Steph Curry when he's dealing with the ankle injury. Obviously, I don't think D'Angelo will get to that level, but there is potential to get more value for the contract. And I think that's something that you almost need to happen when you're going to have a championship team, or like you said with the draft, where you have cost control, you're able to kind of manage those contracts moving forward. And that allows you to bring in big fish, something that's happening in Philly right now with Embiid and Simmons not on huge contracts, bringing in Jimmy Butler, having that cap space in the following offseason, now moving forward with more. But moving on from there, we did get some positive notes. Michael Scotto of The Athletic posted this on Twitter, and this is a quote from Kenny Atkinson. This is on Caris LeVert. I know he's in the gym shooting, I'll say that. That's about as much as I can say, but progressing on schedule and looking forward to having him back. So, I mean, that's as positive as you can get. He's already shooting, and they're looking forward to having him back. So that signals that we're going to see him again this season. What were your thoughts when you saw this, Jack?
Oh, man, it's nothing but good things because, you know, we didn't really know what the progress was going to be with this injury. You know, you spoke to Matt Nguyen about, you know, the sort of really weird nature of the injury as well. So to see Caris LeVert even doing anything now, because, you know, you want to obviously, you know, immobilize the foot, sort of, you know, rest as much as possible. But, you know, he's already out there shooting, and, you know, it hasn't been that long since that injury even occurred. So for it to happen so quickly shows that there are good signs. And I mean, less than a month ago. So we know how resilient our boy is. We know how quickly he can recover. So it's good signs early, but, you know, that's not to say that there won't be setbacks along the way. There won't be tribulations, but I think a guy as headstrong as Caris LeVert, and to get this sort of positive feedback, because, you know, you want to sort of make your progress, you know, have your mini goals along the way. And I think that this is one little tick for Caris and the sort of trainers and the medical staff there at Brooklyn, that he can sort of go, cool, okay, now I can shoot. What's the next step for me that I need to do? I need to start to work up to running, to jogging, all these different things, hitting on the treadmill, swimming. It's wonderful news, but it's one of many that we hope to see, and hope to see Caris tick off in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, and this is getting ahead of myself a little bit, but if, let's say, Caris LeVert was able to come back sooner than expected and get bounced back and play at the form he did, it would also look really good for the Nets training staff and performance team, and that's something you can sell to free agents as well. So something to keep an eye on in that aspect. Very nice to see Caris LeVert. And I also saw one of the beat writers tweet this as well. They saw Caris LeVert walking around the locker room with no boot on. So that means that his, you know, his foot is probably a little bit more stable now, and the dislocation wasn't maybe quite as bad as it looked.
Yeah, maybe his body is just so quick when it comes to healing and the swelling and stuff. So that's a wonderful sign for Caris, because we know the issues that he's had, you know, since his college days in Detroit. So it's a very, very welcome sign. But, you know, like you sort of said, if Caris can get back in the medical stuff, you know, Jared Dudley has raved about, you know, all the things that, you know, free agents look for. And I think Brooklyn are starting to put themselves on the map. And, you know, if you're comparing it to, say, like a Philadelphia, who has struggled many a times with their sort of guys in terms of how they've been able to manage. You look at Joel Embiid, you look at Ben Simmons, you look at Markelle Fultz, you look at Zaire Smith, Jimmy Butler, who hasn't undergone any sort of issues so far, but we know he is injury prone. And when he starts to sort of, you know, encounter that, you know, in his time in Philadelphia, how are the medical staff going to deal with it there? You know, Chicago with Derek Rose and other sort of organizations. So, you know, it certainly is, like I mentioned in terms of Caris LeVert with the ticks, it's a tick for the Brooklyn Nets organization, and a minor selling point when it comes to attracting free agents.
And it also could kind of give some motivation to the other players in the team. You know, we saw the two back-to-back wins. And like we talked about, the East is so bad, the Nets are three games out of the playoffs. You know, you see your, you know, arguably your best player come back, you know, or possibly come back soon. You're right. You're like, all right, long as we can keep this close, we get him back, maybe we can get over that hump. So definitely a really positive note for the Nets in general.
Absolutely. Anything positive, you know, in what was, you know, a pretty wholly negative situation, especially early on before the positive news about the recovery, we'll take it and we'll roll with it.
Exactly. Like I said to you via DM, music to my ears. Now, talking a little bit, Kenny, and obviously he's been arguably, you know, the main discussion of Nets Twitter, and that's, should the Nets be unhappy with Kenny Atkinson, or should they be happy with what he's got the team where he's got the team so far?
I think that you can't be wholly happy with what he's done, Nick, but I think if you're going, you know, in terms of what he has done so far, and if we're basing it purely off this season, he has done more good than bad. you know, the we mentioned on the last pod when we were recapping some of the games, you know, his ability to sort of have that game recognition when to call the timeouts. You know, D'Angelo Russell, you know, the criticisms came of him in terms of playing in crunch time, you know, man management, player management. But we also did at the same time in the Toronto game praise him for how he used Ed Davis and Jared Allen, how he sort of managed the front court minutes. So, you know, he is doing plenty good. And I think you need to compare it to across the league. And in terms of, you know, for all the people that are calling for Coach Kenny to be fired, we have, he's by no means one of the best sort of coaches in the NBA. He is not Popovich. He's not Steve Kerr. He's not Brad Stevens. He's not one of these guys. But he is in a tier that is above guys like who I don't necessarily rate, like JP Bickerstaff, you know, Igor Kokoshkov, guys who are even unknown. Guys like Jim Boylan, who in 2 days is already sort of having guys wanting to ditch practice. You know,
crazy. For professional NBA players, like, that coaching staff is just rough. That whole Chicago team seemed to be clean house.
And it's ridiculous because he's trying to set a new culture and standard, but he's going too far and above. Whereas I think Coach Kenny has an understanding and a cohesion with the front office and with his players, and he's got to buy in from them. You know, every time you hear D'Angelo Russell post-game, you know, obviously we probably construe things in different ways when, you know, D'Angelo Russell, he's asked, you know, was he happy with the fact that he wasn't played in the closing minutes? And he's like, you know, whatever coach has asked of me. You can only take him from face value, and he has still continued to perform. He hasn't sulked or whatever. He hasn't sort of, you know, created a rift within the team. You know, the team is still together. So I think that speaks volumes to Coach Kenny, because he has been, you know, I think you can, I would say probably more so than Sean Marks been the culture setter. I think Sean Marks has provided all of the avenues for him and all of the resources, but it's ultimately on the coach to sort of set the culture, set the standard in terms of practices, in terms of game day. And you hear plenty of other guys around the NBA who aren't Nets fans and who are just general media and pundits, and they say that they just love watching the Nets play. And you couldn't say that about, you know, plenty of other teams. I think that Coach Kenny is probably in a rung where he's, you know, still yet to be determined, but he is doing a lot of good things right now. And for those that, you know, continue to doubt him, then you need to also recognize the good that he's done, because, you know, it's a folly to just ignore all the good that he's done and just focus solely on the bad.
I think, you know, going to this, I think you, I'm not just looking at this year, I'm looking at his whole, you know, stint with the Nets so far, and you have to be happy with what he's done. I don't think you really can be unhappy, because he's given us players when the Nets really had nothing. You know, you look at guys like we already mentioned, Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris, the development of Caris LeVert, development of Jared Allen, and you mentioned D'Angelo and not getting mad with him. D'Angelo, first thing he did on that big interview after the Raptors game was defend the coaching staff. He said, you know, the criticism they were getting was unfair, and that now you see him, you know, one of the players who was benched in the fourth quarter at times, go out there and defend him. I think that says a lot. And one thing I like about Kenny, he doesn't think he's the best coach. He doesn't think that he's Greg Popovich or Brad Stevens. He knows he needs to improve, and that's something that players can appreciate. He admits when he's wrong. One thing I've always liked about him, too, and you mentioned some of the other guys around the league that have worked with him, like Al Horford, Kyle Korver. You know, Horford mentioned he's one of the hardest working guys, coaches in the gym, and he just gets in there and he grinds with you, and I think players can really appreciate that. And another thing, like you mentioned, Jack, not only the media members, but hearing other NBA coaches really give them props, and for the system that they run, it's so modern and fits for the NBA. I mean, if they had better talent, the schemes that they run are great. You know what I mean? The ball movement, high three-point shooting, you know, either layups or threes, same thing defensively. We're not going to let them shoot threes. We're not let them get layups. We're going to force them mid-range shots. I think philosophy-wise, I love what he does. Obviously, the details in managing the game still need to improve. Rotations, substitution patterns need to improve. But also, you know, the devil's advocate could just be like, you know, the talent isn't necessarily there. Has he even coached an all-star player yet other than Brook Lopez?
And he also turned him into a three-point shooter.
And
so
dominant tonight against the Raptors, hitting some step-back threes. He unlocked players that didn't even know they could do it.
You can't doubt that. But I think what a lot of people would sort of, you know, argue, and maybe they would probably say, look, he's just a glorified player development coach. I get that to a sense, because, you know, that's probably been his key skill so far and his key takeaway. But I think we need to wait and sort of before we make an entire judgment and, you know, make rash decisions about, you know, the future of Kenny. Because like he has said, you know, we've mentioned, you know, he's not perfect, and he's mentioned he's not perfect. I mentioned before as well, I just want to continue to see that passion from him. And I want him to sort of, you know, portray that through the media as well, because we know how much he is invested in games. And like all coaches, pretty much. But, you know, I want to see that reflected in, you know, the post-game presses. And he has shown that in wins. But in losses, I want to see the frustration from him. You know, I want him to see, you know, he's like, okay, I'm not happy with some of these guys. You know, I'm not happy with the officials or whatever it might be. Because I think that's going to seep through the culture as well. Because we do have, you know, really young leaders and young stars on the rise. So I think he needs to sort of, you know, that's one thing. And it's not a criticism because, you know, if he's going to continue this sort of politician route, I don't really care. It's not that necessarily my cup of tea, but it doesn't change his coaching philosophy and the more important things. I'm sort of just nitpicking, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we do. That's, you know, our job here is to break it down in all multiple aspects. But for me, I think the big factor still, like you said, Jack, the player development has been his key skill. And I think that's not something to underrate, because you see teams around the league, just perfect example, Orlando Magic. They had all these great players. They had Tobias Harris. They had Victor Oladipo. Alfred Payton was even having a good year in New Orleans before he got hurt. They couldn't develop in Orlando, and they ended up going elsewhere, and they got nothing for them, essentially. So now you have a coach that you know is going to get the best out of guys. It allows you to feel more confident. Obviously, we said, I know personally, I agree with all the philosophies he has. It's just more so about getting some of the smaller details in the game, the in-game stuff down. And, you know, that's going to come with more experience. He's been coaching for a while, but a lot internationally, a little bit in the NBA, and most of his roles has been player development. So it's almost like he's learning on the run.
Yeah, it's about developing his instinct, so to speak, knowing when to sort of, and I think, you know, the best coaches sort of, you know, we saw Steve Kerr last season. He's just like, look, I don't even need to coach these guys. They need to coach themselves.
Exactly.
But at the same, right now, there is no way that the Brooklyn Nets are even close to being in such a situation, because, like you mentioned, Nick, the talent on board, and in terms of where the Nets want to be, you know, it's not. But that's what you want to do. You want to coach players so they become coaches themselves out on the court. And I think we're starting to see glimpses of that going forward. You know, I think a guy like Spencer Dinwiddie will one day make a great coach. And I think a lot of that has to do with having a role model like Kenny Atkinson as his head coach. So I think, you know, you want to coach leaders, you want to coach communicators. And I think that that's one key aspect that he is doing very, very well in terms of communicating to his players. Maybe not so much to guys like, you know, Kenneth Faried or D'Angelo Russell at times, but, you know, we don't see what happens behind closed doors.
Exactly. And I think another thing to think about is just like, what the Nets' goal is this season. We don't know directly. Obviously, they want to be competitive. They want to improve. But how much is it about developing and still setting the culture? It's only a couple years in, and they want to have this culture set in stone, and doing, making mistakes and keeping guys in sometimes isn't the right thing to do. Or sometimes it's playing the younger guys and letting them get more minutes. So I think the verdict is still out for him. I think he's done a great job so far, but a lot of that's just been the player development. And it's been putting in the philosophy. Now it's about managing the game and taking that next step. And that's something we're going to see probably more of next season when they're able to get some better pieces hopefully in here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of fans are frustrated with the fans, like, why can't we judge him now? Why can't we judge him now? When is the time? I think, you know, we sort of said that this season you can make certain judgments about him, and we sort of have. And if he doesn't make a certain improvements, and, you know, when extra talent gets on the roster and the Nets should be pushing for, and there are, you know, higher expectations on him. But, you know, I think if you're going generally by the expectations on him, you know, he might have, in certain aspects, you know, not exceeded them. But I think for the most part, he's exceeded them and the team as a whole.
Yeah, I think the combination of him and Sean having a good relationship and getting guys in here that he can work with and make better and give the Nets assets moving forward, where now they can kind of work and build this roster up. Because it's easy to forget where the Nets were at, where they really had absolutely no young talent, no culture. They were just a laughing stock of the NBA, and that's no longer the case. They're getting respect from other coaches, other teams, other broadcast teams, other NBA media members. So, and part of that is Kenny, part of that is Sean, part of that is the entire organization and the players. But I think it's a little bit too early to be unhappy with what he's done. And also, you lose your closer. You know, LeVert was closing for the Nets in these big games. He's hit some game winners this year already. And then not having him trying to adjust on the run, it's not only on the coach, it was on the players not adjusting. And I think now the next stretch we'll have a better idea what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a game by game situation, and I think, you know, it's very easy to sort of make rash judgments and sort of, you know, hyperbolic sort of statements about the his general future with the organization. But, you know, I think once we have, you know, greater body of work, you know, it's much easier to sort of go because, you know, you look on the fact that we beat the Toronto Raptors. Do we do that without Kenny Atkinson and his schemes and his philosophies and his player development? Certainly not. But at the same time, you know, he has made his mistakes and in terms of, you know, the player execution and other things as well. So I think, you know, he has done more than a good job, but there is plenty of room to improve, and he has acknowledged that, and we have acknowledged that.
Exactly. And we're hoping that, honestly, I know I'm personally hoping that he can develop and become the coach that we want him to be because I've liked what he's done so far with Brooklyn and the relationships you see around the league and the respect he has makes the Nets more enticing. And the Nets wouldn't be a target by other free agents or other agents on the market saying they want their players to come here if it wasn't for Kenny in the culture. So he's had his hand in that. But moving on from there, touching on Caris LeVert, who I think this season was probably playing like a top 50 player. So my question is if you for you, other than LeVert, if he comes back 100% healthy and continues to improve, he's probably top 50. Who else on the Nets roster next season could be a top 50 player?
I think there's generally three players, Nick, that we could probably put in that conversation. And, you know, it's Jared Allen, it's D'Angelo Russell, and it's Spencer Dinwiddie. I think D'Angelo Russell, you know, if he makes an all-star team, does that make him a top 50 player? Yeah, probably around that sort of mark. But if you're looking to the top 50 sort of player series that Corey and I did for ggbasketball.com, you know, guys like Tobias Harris, Lou Williams, Gary Harris, you know, Robert Covington, these sort of players are very, very good players. So to take that sort of leap, which, you know, again, Coach Kenny mentioned in the preseason, it's going to take some real work and some real major strides. So I think the most likely candidate for me is D'Angelo Russell because his ceiling is the highest out of those three. I think Spencer Dinwiddie has a shot at becoming a sort of the prototypical backup guard in the NBA, but I think he is more of a 70 sort of guy, maybe, you know, early 60s. And Jared Allen as well, who I've done a piece for ggbasketball.com as one of the maybe top eight, top 10 centers in the league, but, you know, in a position where he's around the sort of mark of a guy like Steven Adams, who has taken further strides and in the defensive player of the year conversation, Al Horford has fallen off a little bit. So I think you roll the dice and say it's those sort of three, but for me, I'd probably go, judging by sort of age and general on-court production, I'd go D'Lo, I'd go Spencer, and then I'd go Jarrett.
So yeah, I have Jared first. I
Okay.
think Jared's two-way ability gives him the biggest chance to make the jump because we've already seen the potential for defensive impact. If he was able to, you know this, we're both, you know, in our mid to late 20s, that after you kind of get that grown man age where you start to put on muscle, you put on size a little bit. If Jared Allen could do that this summer, I believe he's 20, turning 21. So he adds that size. We already see the other skill sets there, the instincts there. His defensive awareness has taken a major jump this year. We see him attacking the offensive boards. We see a little bit of, you know, ambidextrous, you know, shooting with his left and his right hand around the rim, the ability to play in that pick and roll, the corner three is developing. And I love from him from the New York Post today. He wants to be great. He doesn't even know how great he can be. I think if there's one guy I feel the safest about who's going to probably have, you know, the lowest floor out of all three of them, I feel like it's Jared Allen. I just think he's a perfect fit for the NBA. You know, D'Angelo, I'd probably have second. And Spencer, like you said, I also think he has a very high floor as well. I think he could probably get into at least a top 100 maybe next year. D'Angelo has the potential to get into the top 50, but he also has the potential to not be in the top 100 next year. So I think it's Jared Allen's the guy that I'm really looking forward to, and I think the strides can really come. And a lot of it is just physical development.
Yeah, there it is. A lot of it is physical development. There are a lot of, you know, young centers on the rise. I sort of, you know, I'm interested to sort of see, you know, our one of our very close friends, Corey Waldron, the center of the future there. You know, is it Miles Turner? Is it Domantas Sabonis? Those sort of two guys, you know, are guys that have potential to sort of be around that mark as well. And for a guy like Jared Allen, who is a couple of years younger as well and has probably as much, if not more, defensive capabilities, it's going to be on him to continue to make, you know, huge strides. And, you know, he's certainly got all the capabilities. He's got the mindset to do so. And I think he's got the right system and the right coaching around him. Because, you know, if we're sort of going by, you know, Clint Capela is probably, you know, Rudy Gobert, these sort of guys are, you know, I think the ceiling of a Jared Allen is probably an early 30s by, you know, when he's at his sort of peak. But I think that would be, you know, still a very wonderful player and a guy who is, you know, a number two, number three, and, you know, the defensive stalwart for a championship contender.
Exactly. I think that's what he can be. And I think the defensive value is going to be there where he can really be that guy you look to. And, you know, I don't have the Nets numbers in front of me on off, but I would imagine defensively he has a huge impact. I know the advanced metrics are on his side for some of the stats. I look at him, you know, on the defensive end really having a chance, but offensively it's kind of unknown. We've seen development that we didn't necessarily expect this early in his career. You know, we've seen him knock down a couple threes. We've seen the passing improve. We've seen the touch around the rim improve. And we already know about the physical attributes where he can get up, dunk on people and whatnot. So it's really interesting to see what else he can add to his game because he's so young.
Yeah, the fact that he is, you know, he's 20 years old. And the fact that, you know, 5 years time and what we've seen of him, or we've mentioned this before in terms of season reviews on him, the fact that he's shown so much development, there's been, you know, I think, you know, big progress from him this season as well as a rebound, especially on the offensive end. I think the 3-point shot is still going to be an area where, you know, if he wants to become, you know, that top 50 player, it's going to need to be something. But at the same time, I think schematically, he's not being asked to do it as much these sort of days. But what do you think is the number one thing that is going to be the reason why he will become a top 50 player? Is it the defense like you mentioned, Nick?
Yeah, I think defense. I also would make the argument if you gave him another a stretch forward that was reliable, would open up the paint in the pick and roll situation, he'd be able to put up more points. So I think offensively, you know, some scheme thing with players around him would help him kind of take another jump. But I think defensively, the awareness he provides and the shot blocking ability where he really has an impact on other players, even when he's not blocking the shot. And we've seen him block some of the best guys in the league. You know, we know about the Blake Griffin, you know, rejection at the rim and things like that. And I think the passing also is something that's really underrated. And also, I just love the mindset and the mentality that he has. And I feel like he has a mean chip on his shoulder, but he doesn't really show it because he knows that people question him coming to the NBA. And I just like everything about him personality wise. So that kind of adds to it too. I'm not locking him in to be a top 50 next year, but in my eyes, I think he has the best chance.
Yeah, he has a really, really good mindset and a really well-rounded game. Everything is certainly going well for him. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all develops for him.
And one thing I liked in the New York Post interview too, he said they mentioned what's the most important thing with blocking shots. He said obviously timing, but also knowing the personnel. And that shows you that he's already studying players around the league, and that only help him when he kind of gets switched on the other guys depending on how the Nets adjust their scheme. That'd be something where we can kind of see his development. Is he able to really switch on other guards? That's going to only boost up his defensive value. I know you and I were very impressed his rookie season in a game against Atlanta where he kind of locked up Dennis Schroeder. We haven't seen it quite as much, but there's been scenarios where he's put the clamps on other guards and wings where you didn't necessarily expect it.
Yeah, exactly. Funnily enough, Nick, I did a quick little search on NBA.com for his ratings. We are actually better when offensively when he's on the court. So 5.3 points better per 100 possessions, but actually 3.8 points better, worse defensively when he's off. So obviously you take into account his opponents and the fact that he is a starter, but that was quite surprising to me. It's interesting to see maybe the fact that he's surrounded by a guy like D'Angelo Russell sort of brings him down, but I think that you take with that number what you will, because he is by any stretch of the imagination a positive on the defensive end.
Yeah, because I believe he's also second on the Nets in defensive rating behind only Ed Davis at 107. He's at 109. Moose is at 109, but obviously he's only played 7 games. That's been mostly garbage time. And in comparison, other than Ed Davis, you know, whose offensive rating of 130 to 107, you know, we got Jared Allen at 125 to 109. And obviously he's going up against the starters and playing against some of the bigger and better centers where the first unit has their issues defensively, like we mentioned with D'Angelo sometimes, and some of the other guys who Allen Crabbe was have been great. And Joe Harris is obviously had trouble with some of the more athletic wings.
Exactly.
So I'll take the eye test on that one. But anything else in the top 50, Jack?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, Nick, because, you know, what is the ceiling of a Rodion's courts? I don't think it's in that sort of realm of possibility. But I've mentioned before, and I'll continue to mention it, if the Nets draft someone with tremendous upside and we get lucky in the draft, then I think that there is, you know, a very high possibility that a guy like RJ Barrett, you know, Cam Reddish, Zion Williamson, those guys are, you know, very top 50 sort of ready players in terms of their talent and upside as well.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a guy like Luka, who's probably already top 50 this season. So anytime,
easily,
yeah, you get a top draft pick like that, it's going to really change your franchise. Now, moving on to some other topics that you kind of helped me with as well. Would you rather trade for Frank Ntilikina or Markelle Fultz?
Personally, I'm a Nilla Kina man, Nick. We saw yesterday what he was able to produce when he was on the court. Finally, you know, our boy Mike Ryan is working, did a nice piece on Frank Nilla Kina and sort of, you know, the situation surrounding him and why Fizdale, it continues to give him DNPs, you know, over guys like Trey Burke and Emmanuel Mudiay, who are good-ish, but, you know, Frank Nilla Kina has such, you know, high upside, and he's never going to realize it if he's not on the court. So I think he'd be a perfect fit as well in terms of defensively. You know, he would automatically be our best defender. And I don't mind this three ball. You know, he hit a couple against us. You know, just good things happen when he is on
the court. Against Charlotte, too. I think he knocked down 4 threes in 5 minutes.
So, like, if you're looking at that automatically, you know, I think, you know, you've already got at least, you know, a relatively low floor for him, which is, you know, one of the best defensive point guards in the NBA and one of the best guard-to-guard defenders in the NBA. So I think if that's his floor, then you can just have him out there for defensive possessions and in crunch time and such. Then I think that is much better than a guy like Markelle Fultz, who there are so many questions surrounding him. And yes, he is number one pick. And yes, you know, he has, you know, probably the higher upside offensively. But is he, the floor is, you know, that low? It's a lot scarier of a proposition.
Yeah, I think you look at Nilla Kina, and like you said, Jack, the defense is already there. We saw him against the Nets. We've seen him against other guards in the league. Obviously, he's not elite yet. His, you know, defense still needs little touches here and there detail-wise, because we saw Spencer Dinwiddie blow by him a couple times in the clutch. But I think Nilla Kina is a guy I think that's more of a fit for the Nets team, and I would love to fit next to D'Angelo, or then you throw him and Caris LeVert both out there. Now you have two, you know, really good perimeter defenders, something that the Nets have really lacked for a long time. So I'm a Nilla Kina train. I also think you might be able to get him a little bit easier. Obviously, trading with your crosstown rivals is a little bit difficult. But Markelle Fultz, it seems like being number one overall pick not that long ago, the Sixers are going to ask for too much.
Yeah, and the money that he's commanding right now, it's, you know, it's very questionable for a guy like me. And I don't think that he's, you know, it would be almost a glut, you know, sort of dead money on a roster. And especially that's not what we want as the Brooklyn Nets and the front office as well.
Yeah, if you asked me maybe a year or two ago, I might have went with Fultz because I was looking more for the upside. But I think in the Nets situation right now, they're looking to be better sooner rather than later.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, like you said, Jack, the floor for Frank is maybe worst case scenario. He's possibly a 3-and-D, you know, point guard that you can bring off the bench. I think that's a great fit for almost any team in the league. Now, talking trades, Jack, obviously December 15th is when, you know, the trades can really start cooking. That's when you can start to trade some of the guys you signed in free agency. Now, considering the Nets roster, who are some guys you think will possibly trade or you'd like to see be moved between December 15th and the trade deadline?
I don't think that there'll be many moves, Nick, but I think some guys that will be around the conversations are guys like Kenneth Faried, Damari Carroll, maybe even Shabazz Napier, and maybe even Spencer Dinwiddie. It's almost sacrilege to say Spencer Dinwiddie, but you know there'll be teams asking about him. Whether, you know, Sean Marks answers those calls remains to be seen. But I think Damari Carroll makes the most sense because, you know, he is a 3-and-D wing. You know, he's on an expiring contract. You know, he was already been in trade rumors last season around that trade deadline, you know, in teams like Detroit and New Orleans, and even Houston as well. You know, Zach Lowe mentioned in a pod during the preseason that, you know, he sees, you know, Damari, that was the exact idea that he brought up, you know, Damari Carroll to Houston. So, I mean, I would be, he makes the most sense. You know, does Jared Dudley end up leaving? You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think you have to keep some sort of leadership presence on the roster, mentorship presence on the roster. So it'd be interesting to see whether any of those guys are moved. But, you know, I think that and Shabazz Napier, the reason why I brought him up as well is because, you know, he seems to be at times usurped in the rotation and not utilized as often. I think, you know, whether it's a sort of a move that Sean Marks moves to make, you know, out of the kindness of his heart because he wants to see Shabazz get some minutes somewhere and he deserves some playing time because he is, you know, a proven solid backup. So whether he decides to do that as well will be, you know, an interesting proposition.
Yeah, I mean, and he's got a small cap cap number at 1.9 this year, 1.8 next year, you know, maybe get a second round pick for him because they haven't necessarily used him a ton. And I think on a team like the Nets, his defensive, you know, his defensive weakness kind of sticks out a little bit more. On a more defensive minded team where they could hide him with some better defenders, I think it'd be a little bit easier to play him. But pretty much everything you mentioned, Jack, I agree with. I think most cases it's going to be the expiring guys. They're not necessarily going to look to trade any of the guys on the roster that they have under contract because their numbers are so friendly.
Yeah, it's all about the numbers. It's
an interesting guy too. You know, obviously we've absolutely loved Ed, but he maybe could get them something if the Nets didn't feel confident about re-signing him next year.
Well, I think we should already sign him to the max, but we'll leave that for another day. Everyone loves Ed Davis, and I think you can't argue with the fact that how good he has been. I think if there are teams that are looking for a backup center, he's probably the best backup center in the league in terms of what he can provide in the minutes on the court and what you ask for, a sort of backup big, give you some energy, get you some rebounding, get you some offensive putbacks, and you know, play some more than passable defense. But it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out because, you know, Sean Marks, you know, he's never going to say no to deals and no to phone calls. So how it all, you know, plays out, we sort of mentioned, you know, D'Angelo Russell, you know, the question that got asked of us, does he get traded? Who knows? There's anything that can happen in this league.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting, too, of the Nets, where they're at in the standings, if they're looking to compete, if they really think that being more competitive will help them get a big free agent next year, if that's their goal. We really don't know what they're thinking. Are they maybe going to put two lesser players together and try to get another first-round pick or something, and now they're going to have major assets going to that offseason? You know, we do see a lot of big all-stars be traded at that NBA draft day, so there's a lot of different possibilities out there. I mean, the only guys that I'm really confident that will be on the roster next year are Jared Allen, Caris LeVert, and probably Rodion Krutz. Other than that, I'm not 100% confident about anybody else.
Yeah, it's really hard to sort of just lock guys in because, you know, the roster isn't set and it shouldn't be set, especially when you are not a playoff contender like we are.
And the only non-expiring guy that I would like to see them move, and that's Allen Crabbe. And he's technically expiring as a player option for the following season, which he's going to pick up. Maybe if Crabbe could pick up his numbers, I think it would kind of make sense to get rid of him, even if he starts to pick it up, because it just is too scary to have a player that can be so good or so bad.
Yeah, I think, you know, with where we are at right now with Allen Crabbe, unless, you know, some ridiculous things change, you'd almost have to attach an asset for him because of, you know, the number that he's being paid at.
Yeah, exactly. The only other thing I could possibly think of is maybe if you're trading him to someone else that has a two-year deal where it's maybe a little bit lesser number and or a team is just really desperate for three-point shooting and you think Crabbe can bring it to them.
Yeah, he has to be part of some sort of package.
Exactly. But Jack, what do you got for me?
Speaking of packages, Nick, a Nets region on Instagram, this is the sort of key topic that I took the screenshot. And I'm like, okay, this is going to come up on a buzz. So it was a mock trade between the Nets and the Pelicans. The Pelicans received Spencer Dinwiddie and Allen Crabbe in return for Solomon Hill and a 2019 first round pick, which is protected. And if you're looking at where the Pelicans are at now, they're certainly up and down. So whether those protections are, you know, 1 to 20, 1 to 10, it'll be interesting to see if that were to occur. But it's certainly an intriguing package and trade deal.
Yeah, I think looking at this deal, you'd have to be very confident in D'Angelo Russell being a point guard and a guy that you're looking to lock up no matter what the number is in free agency. And I think Solomon Hill, you know, we've seen him play. He just doesn't have it. You know, they signed him to a bigger deal when those salary cap numbers were inflated. In the first round pick, if we were to trade them Dinwiddie, that's a major hole in their team. And I would expect New Orleans to really pick it up because Drew Holiday's really excelled when he's got to play the two guard and doesn't have to manage the show. And Anthony Davis, Spencer Dinwiddie pick and roll would probably be very good. So I'd probably lean against this trade because I like Spencer and I like the potential he gives the Nets. And I'm not saying they need to lock him in as a point guard, but I like him in that extension number to have him as a trade asset after that. I think right now you're not probably getting the best value and then you're just taking on another bad contract that's only helping you by $5 million. I would only say do this if you really think that you're going to get a big fish this summer.
Yeah, the Cavs obviously offered, you know, a first round.
It could end up being.
Yeah, something like that. So Spencer's has exceeded that value already. you know, where do the Pelicans finish right now? You know, they're outside the playoff race. They're probably around the 10 to 15 range. We've obviously got the Denver Nuggets pick as well. So I'd much rather keep Spencer Dinwiddie. I think he's a much more valuable asset. But, you know, like you mentioned, Nick, imagine him on the New Orleans Pelicans. He would add so much to that team. And, you know, he would be, you know, almost the perfect sort of fit with Jrue Holiday and Anthony Davis, the sort of perfect sort of number three sort of guy alongside them. It would certainly give them a lot. But I don't think it makes as much sense for the Nets, though. You know, it depends on how much, you know, faith, like you mentioned, you know, the team has in D'Angelo Russell and what sort of, you know, he has continued to show by that sort of stage. I think Spencer Dinwiddie as well, you know, over the past season and a half has proven to be quite durable. D'Angelo Russell has had his injury history as well. So are you investing in, you know, long-term in D'Angelo Russell just alone? I think that there is a lot of risk in that. So, I think it makes sense, a lot of sense for the Pelicans, and the fact that we would get off Allen Crabb as well, it makes some sense for the Brooklyn Nets, but I would be surprised if that were to become a reality.
Yeah, it's like, is $5 million and probably ending up, you know, like we said, Spencer being such a great fit would boost him in the standings. Is $5 million in cap space and possibly a late first round pick enough to move Spencer Dinwiddie, who's already looks like he could be at least a long-term backup point guard for your team, and you could sign him to a really fair contract?
Yeah, it's not worth it, but who knows?
Yeah, you never know. And there could be other assets included, maybe another second-round pick or, you know, Frank Jackson or something that make it a little bit more enticing.
That's it. There's always, you know, all these deals. It's a fascinating one to analyze still.
Yeah, exactly. Anything else via social media, Jack, or that's about it?
That's it, mate. Most of the other stuff is sort of stuff that we've already discussed. We tend to cover pretty much everything on The Buzz. So, you know, we've got it covered.
Yeah, we got it covered. As always, guys, we appreciate you listening. We appreciate all the support. You can check out the show on iTunes, Bob Talk Radio, OGGBasketball.com, NatsRepublic.com, Dash Radio, and YouTube. Jack, always a pleasure, and always thank everybody for listening.